This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello, and welcome to the Late Late Show. This is Catherine Taylor, and tonight my special guest is Zoe Neagle. I'll be chatting to Zoe about her experience of her first year in a new and challenging role as an assistant head teacher with responsibility for teaching and learning. We'll also talk about Zoe's love of teaching and learning and the place of professional learning throughout a teacher's professional life.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
And welcome to the Late Late Show, everyone. I'm Catherine. I'm speaking to you live from Buckinghamshire in the UK. On tonight's show, I am very excited to be joined by Zoe Neagle. Zoe is just about to enter her 24th year in the profession and doesn't look a day over 25. Tonight, we'll be discussing Zoe's experience of joining a new school in the role of assistant head teacher and the strategies that she has used to make significant and sustained positive changes for learners and teachers. Remember, if you're listening to us live and would like to join us to enter the live studio, post a question in the chat for Zoe to answer, or if you want to call in and speak to us, then please download the Podbean app. Visit ttradio.org and click Listen Live on the homepage. This will take you directly to the show. There you can post comments and questions during our conversation. And once I've spoken to Zoe, I'll open up to any of you who would like to call in. You can call in by pressing the icon in the top of the screen on your phone's app. Call this and I'll be able to connect you. So welcome, Zoe. I'm really excited to have you on the show tonight. How are you today?
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy after a nice reviving Easter holidays. 2 days back, but it feels like 2 weeks, but no, in a good way. It's nice to be back. Final summer term.
Yes. Yeah, it's a long one though, isn't it? Because of early Easter this year.
Yeah, indeed. But, you know, I think it, no matter the length, because we've got the year 11s and the year 13s going and stuff, it does kind of seem like there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Light at the end of the tunnel, exactly. So, Zoe, you have been in your new role for a year. And it's a school in Harrow.
Yeah, right? North London.
North London. And I just think it'd be great to hear you set the scene for us. So what's it like on a typical day or a week in the day of the life of Zoe Neagle?
Well, from my perspective, I think you're right. I'm just going to go back a little bit, because literally to a year to the day, and this morning, because yesterday we had inset day, and this morning I stood in what we call the plaza, which is basically a patio out the front of the school, but it sounds very the plaza, and I reminisced in terms of what I was thinking and feeling a year ago today, and how much that had changed to today. And I swelled with pride, because not only did I know each and every one of these wonderful learners that were walking through with their smiles on their faces, and I was wishing them back into school, but you know, just the whole feel and the culture felt different. And there was a very different feel of what was coming into the school. And so I'm not, you know, all teachers in every school, whatever the context, it's a busy, busy life. So the day in the life of Zoe Neagle is that we don't stop from, you know, 7:50 in the morning. You don't have time to kind of stop and catch your breath until at least 5 o'clock in the evening. And you know, that's not just me, that's the team. I'm very lucky to work with a wonderful team, and that's everybody that's around us. But what I love, what I particularly love, and I think that's is that you can never quite tell what the day's going to bring. You can never quite tell, no matter how much you plan, you always have to be available to swerve certain things and change and rethink and instantaneously make new decisions, because in the best interest of the people that you have in front of you, albeit the staff or the students, you know, and in, you know, in some of the cases, animals, because we deal with some therapy dogs, etc. And so sometimes that's, yeah, that's a little bit different. But yeah, it keeps me on my toes. A day is me keeping on my toes. And I have to say, after investing in a watch that can kind of focus on the amount of steps, certainly on a daily basis, those steps kind of go up and down and up and down.
And I remember when you first joined, you rang me one evening and you said, I feel like I've taken off my comfy slippers and now I'm in heels every day.
Yeah. I'm running uphill in heels. It's never good.
Do you feel like, you know, that's still the case?
Yeah, I'm not. Yes, I think I'm not quite back into my slippers, but actually, I actually think I should never really be back into my slippers.
Yeah.
Those slippers are there for the time outside of work. I think, it's not too painful. I've certainly worn those shoes in, and I'm really liking my strides now. I'm really enjoying it. And I think it's always healthy as leaders, and it's always healthy as professionals to come out of that safe zone into the challenge zone, you know, like we do for our learners. Albeit I was slightly in that panic zone in the first few weeks, but kind of moved back very quickly with the help of lots of wonderful colleagues to get back into that challenge zone and really set myself challenges as an individual, as a teacher myself, as a leader, as a new colleague to other people, and think about kind of reinventing myself in a new scenario and what did I want to keep from all of my years' experiences and what did I want to have fresh and, you know, with clarity moving into a new position.
And what would you say was your main keep?
My main keep was authenticity.
Yeah.
Was a sense of humour. Was a foot firmly in to knowing that I was doing the right thing. That's not only morally, but that's also being guided by the research, because it's one thing to be a really nice person and to try and do your best all the time, but you also need to be led, as we're professionals, we need to be led by what the research says and what is going to have the best impact and what is going to be the best use of everybody's time in order to get those shared goals.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. And what was your biggest leave, do you think?
Moaning. The moan. Yeah, and the not only myself moaning, but allowing for the moan. Mm-hmm. Allowing for the moan in climates where the kind of conversationally things would moan and fester. And I think I've worked really hard, and I might talk about this later, but also in kind of coaching conversations and that, to kind of turn that around, to turn the moan into something a bit more positive and not kind of let myself indulge in the, you know, because there's lots of difficulties on a daily basis. There's lots of difficulties for everybody. And if we focus on that all of the time, then it can become quite a dark place. But
No, brilliant. Right, well, I'm going to play a couple of messages and then we'll come back to Zoe and we'll hear about the work that she's done with a research base and a structured approach with an optimistic outlook and years of experience. And so let's hear a few messages and we'll be back with you in a moment.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support headteachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC reported on a long-term study by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which found children living near Sure Start centres did better at GCSE. The research says these living near a centre performed up to 3 grades better than those living further away. Sure Start began in 1998 to support new parents, especially in disadvantaged areas, but due to austerity, many have since closed. The Department for Education said its Family Hub scheme had a number of advantages over the Sure Start model. The IFS study used postcodes from when children were age 5 to determine proximity to centres and looked at the GCSE results of those children 11 years later. It found what it describes as big improvements in performance in those living near a centre, especially those from low-income backgrounds. Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Labour Chancellor at the time the initiative was launched, said the UK now needs a new Sure Start, and described the results as what most parents already know, that a supportive environment in early years was life-transforming. Among all children in the study, those who live near a Sure Start centre performed better than those who lived far away, but the trend was most pronounced amongst those eligible for free school meals and those from minority ethnic backgrounds. According to The Guardian, schools in England could lose up to £1 billion in funding by 2030, with exceptional falls in pupil numbers prompting closures. Mergers and school closures are already happening in parts of London, where pupil numbers have been falling for some time. According to the think tank Education Policy Institute, the North East is projected to see the greatest decline in primary pupil numbers, down by 13% by 2028-29. At secondary school level, Yorkshire and Humber, the North East and London are projected to have the largest falls in pupil numbers, although other areas, including the West Midlands and the South East, have rising numbers. Pupil numbers had grown because of a fertility surge in the 2000s, but as that cohort has moved through, numbers are now falling. Even with increases in per pupil funding, the EPI predicts schools will find it hard to balance budgets as fewer pupils do not lead to reduced costs. The decline is due mainly to a falling birth rate and changing migration patterns. Full details of the EPI projections can be found on the Guardian website. Schools Week reports on the decision by Ofsted to appoint a former chief inspector, Dame Christine Gilbert, to lead the independent inquiry into its response to the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine served as the HMCI from 2006 to 2011 and now chairs the Education Endowment Foundation. The Learning Review follows a coroner's ruling in December that an Ofsted inspection contributed to the death of Mrs. Perry, then head teacher of Caversham Primary School. The review will consider actions Ofsted took in response to hearing about the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine will have access to relevant records, Ofsted staff, and the opportunity to meet with Ruth Perry's family as part of the review. The review will not examine the November 2022 inspection of Caversham Primary. Teaching unions have expressed concern about the appointment of Gilbert, saying it was critical that the review was robust, independent, and impartial, and that some would, rightly, question the notion of a former HMCI reviewing the work of Ofsted. A report will be completed after the review and recommendations will focus on future actions. Schools Week also reports on a plan for the Department for Education to work with the Scout Association to provide 40,000 explorers, those aged 14 to 18, with the skills and knowledge they need to consider a career in teaching. The DfE will work with the Scouts to create age-appropriate activities that inspire young people to consider a career in teaching, linking to relevant badges and awards. It did, however, clarify that there are currently no plans for a teaching badge. The policy is part of the DfE's Get Into Teaching plan, which aims to elevate the status of the profession and target new audiences who have not yet considered teaching as a career. The scheme will launch in September, and it is hoped that it will reach 40,000 young people. The Scouts will create support and guidance material for those running the programme. The initial one-year contract is worth £43,000, but can be extended subject to budget availability. Finally, a teenager who campaigned for skateboarding to be included in school qualifications is proud to see it added to the list of approved GCSE sports in Wales. According to the report on the BBC News website, Qualifications Wales has added 13 new sports to the approved list for GCSE PE. Other newly allowed sports include BMX, shooting, kickboxing and wakeboarding. The new Made for Wales GCSE in Physical Education and Health will be available for first teaching from September 2026. The change makes Wales the second UK nation to include skateboarding, behind Northern Ireland. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Welcome back. Thank you to Jo for that news there. And we're back here with Zoe Neagle, who is going to talk a little bit about her context before digging a little deeper. So tell me a bit about your school, Zoe. What kind of context are you in?
So actually, quite uniquely, I am in a through school. So the school kind of provides educational service from right down in EYFS all the way up to year 13. And it's quite a privilege for me, really, because previous to this role, I have had very little, other than being a parent, contact with the primary sector. And now, actually, as part of my leadership, and by the very nature of it being a through school, that the leadership takes pride and focus on it being all through. So looking at each of the different phases and how one feeds into the other, and how our students may start at the school and then grow all the way up until that. But like I say, we're situated in North London. We are in an area of high social deprivation. Mm-hmm. So we're dealing with lots of kind of poverty within there. We spend a lot of time dealing with the local community. We have got lots of new members to the country. Some of our pupils come very recently with lots of English is an additional language need, or sometimes we're no English at all. And then we also have people that leave us and go on to different things. So there's quite a lot of movement within the school, and that presents. We do have quite a lot of SEND students as well. And actually, one of the areas that I'm working within Harrow is looking at creating an alternative provision area as well. So
within that
area of North Harrow. So that's really interesting to kind of look at how we focus and keep the education as the main priority for the student and give them all the necessary support that's bespoke for that student. So it's an interesting mix, a very diverse intake, and we work really hard. Again, with this year, it's been a real pleasure kind of really interacting with the local community in a manner of ways, from offering a community iftar to kind of inviting them in for tours around the school, or to see our library, the book fairs, etc. So it's been a really interesting journey, and that kind of richness really plays to the strengths of what we're trying to do as a school.
And I remember when you first started there, because it's a through school, you observed some of the dynamics between the older and the younger children. I wonder if you can tell us a bit about that.
Yes, and I think, it's like watching poetry in motion, and it's some of the best beats of human mankind when you have your 6'2" year 11 boys playing football, and then suddenly like ducklings come across the playground, like year ones. And it's a real privilege and an honour to see these wonderful young men. They stop, regardless of how rowdy they've been playing football previously or across the basketball, but they pause and then they watch, and then you see that. And to just to witness that beautiful, that kind of respect, that, and because and the interaction, sometimes they do high fives, sometimes they do fist bumps to each other. And yeah, that dichotomy between the, you know, the two sizes and the two phases is beautiful, and actually makes anyone's heart smell. It really is.
Brilliant. That's really great. But let's talk a little bit about the journey that you've been on, and that the school has been on, and that you have led the school on, Mrs. Neagle. So we're going to break it down a bit to be a bit sort of technical. We've got an implementation framework that we're going to kind of walk through. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your experiences as you began to explore and prepare for what you found when you got there, the way you identified the challenges that you needed to address.
I think I was lucky that I started at the same time as a new head, and so I wasn't the only person on that kind of new journey, that kind of auditing, a stepping back. And I think as a leader, and having, you know, done some leadership training, I think this was something that I really did need to hold on to, is the idea of that patience and kind of watching, learning and thinking, and not trying to run in straight away and think that you wanted to change everything. So I think a real that in the first instance, it was a real case of, and now I'm really thankful for that time, for that first half term to the term, to really watch, learn and feel like we get an understanding of that school within its context and the learners and the staff. Because I think as a leader, what the danger is that you go in and you try and fix all the cracks, or you try and put plasters on the holes, and actually what you're doing is it is just surface. And so trying to get a real understanding for the genuine needs, and then to try and think about what that priority is and what in the first instance is going to make a fundamental difference to all of the students that are in the school. What is going to make everyone's lives better? What are the first things? So in terms of doing that kind of audit, there was a lot of conversations, there was a lot of observations, there was a lot of talking to students, there were a lot of talking to parents, there were a lot of just watching and trying to understand how and why things are done the way that they are, and trying to think about, you know, what's a keep and what's a go and where what needs to move. So I think in terms of, you know, that first phase, the explore phase, is really about exploring the bespokeness of the school, and therefore what and where the journey needs to start. And as a leadership team, I'm really lucky that the head teacher that we work with is really keen in terms of supporting the team element. So it's about listening to people's voices and making people feel empowered, that we're kind of onboarding the stakeholders and making them feel heard. So it isn't just what we're thinking from a new, fresh professional lens. It's about asking the voices of everybody. And I think that was a really valuable process as well, is speaking to people, finding out what they really enjoyed about school, what are the things that didn't, and listening to that pupil voice, listening to the staff voice, listening to parent voice, and really triangulating those opinions, because actually they're really important for our school. And then lots of different kind of meetings and plans, and try to go. And I think this is something that I've learned, and certainly with my head's kind of coaching as well, is thinking about what can we do right now, you know, and how let's do something small that has a big impact to kind of let's move forward. So one of the first things that we looked at is getting a sense of community. Mm. So when we moved into the, I think I said earlier, then I was in the plaza, there was the previous year, I actually asked one of our colleagues if it was Mufti Day on the first day, because there, you know, there was just a lack of cohesion with the school uniform and they weren't really following. And again, it was probably something to do with post-COVID. But when I looked at the students today walking through, I really got a sense of pride because they were wearing their tie with you know, everybody, it's not even a negotiable now to wear their tie.
I want to ask you about the ties, actually, because you've got a lovely story and I just think this is absolute genius. How did you get the tie thing sorted?
Well, actually, as I said, we do come from an area, you know, our context is an area of great social deprivation, so therefore finances, it does become problematic. So we took we try and take a very commonsensical approach and kind of think about what the essence. So in terms of the uniform, we decided that we didn't need blazers, but we do need black trainers, so black shoes, they could be trainers or could be shoes, but black footwear with black trousers, a white shirt and a school tie. And the school tie was something that was becoming problematic because we were having lots of excuses that they couldn't remember. So we came up with a plan that as the year 11s were leaving, they would get a free gift of some sweets if they would donate their tie. So therefore we could then pass them on to the year 7s. And it turned out to be wonderfully successful. I've never bought so much sweets in my confectionery in my entire life. So and it ended up being quite a buzz for the year 11s as they were leaving to be able to hand their tie on to you know, a younger member of the community, and that was lovely. So that also meant that we have an extra storage of ties. And so when we meet and greet our students at the door, if they have forgotten their tie, then we're able to kind of replace them and let them borrow one. So we do expect high expectations, but it's not an entirely punitive thing all of the time. So it's, we're helping and supporting our students. So the uniform for a sense of community was one of the first things that we decided to approach. And that really did start to drive up those standards, you know, standards everywhere. And also the head, and really modelling how we would expect our young people to interact with us. So a very obvious good morning and smiles and cheerfulness. And I think one thing I'm really proud of is that the overall atmosphere of our school is always quite cheerful, and it's modelled. And, you know, they say a smile is contagious. And it really is fascinating to see how that magic works. And so when we greet our students in their wonderful school uniform now, then it's remarkable how quickly they will do that, and they can kind of pick up on that excitement and happiness and kind of come on in and do that. So like I said, again, going back to that, when in terms of it changing, it took very little time actually to see a significant change in terms of the uniform, because we did have high expectations and there were consequences, and very quickly those consequences were heard and felt by students if they didn't, despite given warnings, if they didn't you know, follow what our expectations, the ways that we would expect them to conduct themselves and see. And I think so that sense of community was really lovely. We also had something in terms of looking at the community of the school, but also looking at the community, the wider community. So we had a cultural day whereby we could celebrate the cultures of everybody, and then everybody was encouraged to dress from their culture and eat from their culture and discuss things from their culture to kind of bring that sense of cohesion. So even though lots of our students come from different places, once they become within our school gate, they're one, we are all one community. So I think that was one of the first things. The second thing was behaviour around school. That was the most obvious thing that we knew. There were some bad habits that had been formed. There was a slight discrepancy between the behaviour that you would see in the lower school in the primary and then what you would see in the secondary. And lots of things in terms of thinking about changing lunch times or thinking about areas and redefining where certain year groups may, you know, go. So there were some strategic things that we could kind of get early wins for. But overall, it was changing the culture. Mm-hmm. And it was changing the culture slowly but steady and explaining and being transparent all of the time. And I think making decisions, making sure that we could make decisions with the students, but also with our staff body, and understanding the reasons why we're making those decisions and reflecting on the way that those decisions are going to be made and implemented. And then constantly having a look at whether it's worked or not, if that needs tweaking. And I think that for me has been one of the biggest learning curves, is actually having suggestions, taking on board suggestions, dealing with the barriers. Some of the times we want to do things but we can't do because...
Can you give an example of a barrier or a challenge that came up?
I think, yeah, I'm just thinking, well, because we have quite a small site and lots of different things happening all at the same, as you can imagine, sometimes we didn't have the rooming that we needed. We didn't have the space that we needed. So we had to think a little bit more creatively in terms of how we would manage certain areas. For example, we have one school hall, and that hall's used by the primary, the nursery and the secondary. So we couldn't, for example, previously I would have gone, oh, okay, we'll put the detentions in the hall, or we'll put the kind of test in that hall or the assembly, but we couldn't have an assembly because, you know, and so some of the communicative ways involved us thinking a little bit more creatively. But yeah, no, it's been really, really helpful, really lovely. And then it's about looking at that implementation phase and thinking about the timings and how we implement it and who implements it. And
that's kind of moving into our next question, actually, the next area. So maybe just to draw that out a little bit, this you know, assessing the readiness of the staff or the community to put something into place. So how do you kind of do that, you know, the nuts and bolts of getting ready and the actual implementation itself?
So I think beforehand, it's the preparation. It's the preparation and the identifying of what it is, what our shared aim is. And I think that shared aim needs to come from those very valuable professional discussions, looking at surveys, looking, you know, at what people are saying, what the students are saying. And once we have that shared vision, is thinking about how we're going to get to a point where that's worked successfully. And so onboarding all of our staff members, talking about troubleshooting and thinking about that staggered approach in terms of the effective communications. So in terms of our effective communications, we worked with a lot of our sixth forms, and worked with a lot of support staff to ensure that we had multiple languages available for, we had different letters printed in a variety of languages. We had meetings with different languages via Teams where we could send out. We created a new piece of software as, you know, as a school, where we could then have generated messages going out to, because that hadn't been in place before, so that the communication airways were much more robust. And I think that was important for the wider community and parents, and informing parents the rationale as to why we were doing it. And if everything that you are doing is for the best interests of those students in order to be the best that they can be, I think it very quickly becomes evident that lots of people want to do that. And including the students, including the students in having that shared shared vision, and it tying in with our values. And so values as a place. So I think once we'd kind of worked out how we were going to tell the parents, how we were telling our how we were telling our students with staff, we had some meetings individually, then we had team meetings, then we would have a whole succession of assemblies, and using a kind of Teams meeting and form and bulletins. So we would slowly drip feed prior to a major deadline, for example, the evolution of new school uniform, for example, or things that were changing if the new we changed the times of the lunchtime. So we had a key stage 3 lunchtime and a key stage 4 lunchtime. So therefore people, we had more use of a multiple amount of space. So people could, you know, spread out and that was much more kind of serene at lunchtimes for a lot of the students, rather than, because again, our land kind of goes up rather than out, because in North London. And so I think that was really nice. And what was really lovely is then getting that feedback afterwards. So watching, so having these things implemented and looking at how things have kind of embedded within that school culture. You know, initially there might always be some teething problems, but then looking and reflecting and going back and adjusting, and then looking again after half term, after a term, and then looking forward. And I think the transparency and that open communication is something that's really important within the whole school community.
Yeah.
Because when the pupils have a voice and think, oh, that's not happy, or that they're not happy about that, or this is not great, for example, school canteen, something they always have a wonderful opinion
yes,
on.
Yeah, yeah.
And they see some changes in the way that they've said, you know, I think that's really empowering for everybody. Equally with the staff, you know, making sure that we consult the staff and they have an opportunity to say what they think in terms of whether it be a Microsoft form. Sometimes we have an open meeting. Sometimes we take agendas to their subject meetings and they have an opportunity to feedback that way. But certainly making sure that staff have their say. So,
has there been anything that you've kind of had to pivot on, or it hasn't kind of happened in the way you envisioned and you've had to go back and change?
Yes, certainly is. Home learning. So as I entered, and obviously I'm overseas teaching and learning, and I suddenly found myself in the school had previously done home learning in a particular way where there was very little impact in terms of, you know, form tutors were just overseeing some tasks that they were doing. And fundamentally, having explored it, they weren't really doing any of the homework. So we were kind of in a situation where homework or home learning wasn't part of their everyday. It wasn't an expectation. There was nothing. And so I thought I could go in and kind of change this. And then subsequently ended up with about 300 people in detention immediately.
That's why you needed the hall. That's why I wondered.
So I've certainly had to press pause. That's probably been my biggest failure, but also my most challenging, you know, my most learning curve, my significant learning curve, because I'm still not at the end of that now, because then what I had to go back and really focus on, what steps are we going to get to where we can shift that whole culture and that kind of that learning, the love of learning, and giving them the skills to be independent learners and motivated enough at home to continue that learning. And we're not there yet, but we have, you know, that's when I had to talk to the staff members, and they knew the students a lot better than I did at that time, to find out what kind of things would work. And we've opened up a computer room, because lots of them don't have access to computers at home. So we have a homework club that runs every day. We invite students to go to the homework club, and we've had quite a good uptake in terms of students just making sure that they can go and do that. We've looked at different homework providers for literacy and numeracy. They're our big drivers, so looking at those and thinking about how we can embed them. We're still not where we want to be in terms of the students' uptake, but certainly significantly better than they were before, so we're making progress. And then looking at that kind of homework timetable, we're still not there yet, but that's certainly something that I had to press a major pause on, because it went spectacularly wrong. And then go back and rethink. And we haven't quite got the...
But it's about that, you know, it's that readiness, isn't it, for the change. And I think that's a really important thing, is that sometimes we do want things to be done, you know, because... And we'll come to this a bit later, but sometimes you get a phone call and sometimes you fear that you're going to be asked a question about why isn't this being done? And you know that you're trying to achieve it, but you haven't achieved it yet. And I think I think it's completely, you can tell me what you think, I think it's completely legitimate to say this is, we're in a plan, it's a 12-month plan, we're in month four, mm-hmm. this is what we've done, this is what we're doing next, this is whatever. But I think people are a bit fearful of saying we're not finished yet. We either want it to be done. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but
no, I don't think you're wrong at all. I think we spend our whole time with students talking about it being a process, and ultimately improvement is that process and learning and going back and reflecting, and you know, the growth mindset, we're not there yet and all of that. And I think sometimes we as leaders need to think about strategy, and we need to, it needs to be a cohesive vision whereby it's not too overwhelming for all of the people involved. Yeah. Because on reflection in my homework story, it was because I wanted a quick win. It's because I wanted to tick that box with a quick win. But that never works, because that's not a good strategy. Mm-hmm. And actually, at the same time as we were trying to deal with behaviour and trying to deal with, then it was just a kind of cacophony of yelps from everybody, because there was so much going on at the same time. So I think you're absolutely right when you talk about, if you're going to embed significant change for long term, then you need to have a vision. And you need to trust in that process, and you need to give it time. You need to give that time for that to slowly drip feed those things. So before people know it, then these are new habits. And once new habits have changed and it becomes habitual, that's when you can drip feed new things in to take them into, you know, the Goldilocks phase, which is that challenge phase.
You've mentioned Goldilocks. I was just going to mention Aristotle.
Oh, okay. Shows where we are at 9:30 at night on a Tuesday.
Do, aren't we? And we do kind of, we need to build habits, don't we? Otherwise it's just too much. It's almost like cognitive overload.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I think what we need to remember is that what we tell people we should be doing in the classroom for our lessons is what we need to do on a bigger picture for our leaders. And trust that, you know, you can't just, you know, fix something like that, because that's not going to be sustainable change. It's going to be that in the moment. But
no, that's really brilliant. And I did allude to something a moment ago, because you did get a call, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We did. And it was an interesting experience. And I think slightly more premature than we would have liked, but certainly the transition had been happening. And you know, as a team, I'm incredibly proud to work with the team of leaders that I'm working in. And I think everybody pulled together. And it was because of that shared vision of that kind of real authentic strive towards a better place for our learners, that everybody knew what our vision was, where we're working towards, what the stepping stones were. I think our visitors were very able to see what our shared vision was, and were equally happy with what they were seeing being put into place in terms of. So, you know, I think sometimes it's nice from an outside, from whoever the visitors are, to be able to be reassured that what you're doing is okay, and that you're moving in the right direction. Yeah. And I think that's really important as well, is to hear the voices and to hear external voices wherever they come from, whether that comes from, you know, neighbouring schools, whether that comes from the LEA, whether that comes from the Big O themselves, or whether, you know, whether that comes from any kind of support and developmental area. It's really important that you don't just get stuck in that kind of bubble, and you do have a moment of reflection, and that external voice can come in and ask you some of those challenging questions, because our visit, I'm not going to lie, it wasn't a walk in the park. It was rigorous. There was a real sense of integrity about it, but what was lovely is that we were able to be incredibly transparent in all areas. We've done a lot of work, not, you know, in readiness of this, but in readiness of just overall improvement, in looking at areas such as the curriculum and looking at how we sequence our lessons and looking at teaching and learning. And the behaviour for learning was really important. And because we'd managed to make such significant progress in that, they could see where our next phase was. Yeah. Because, you know, again, like I say, when you come back to when I was doing, looking at that diagnostic phase, I think it was very evident for all of us to see that the behaviour of the students weren't at a place where we were able to be successful in the classroom. So we looked at how we implemented our consequences, how we created a sense of pride, our expectations and what it was, so we could get the students to be in the classroom and behaviourally being meeting our expectations, in order for us to then really push that learning and push in for the learning to happen. And we're on a journey. It's really it's about finding the strategies that work for the learners and being able to identify, and that real adaptive learning upskilling our body of staff to be able to adapt. And I think, again, from our visitors and from other visitors, we welcome visitors to come in and kind of see what we're doing, share the good practice that we're doing, because we're a training school. So we spend a lot of the time with ITTs and ECTs and invest in them in terms of the future of the teaching profession, to kind of really look at what good pedagogical practice is and what the impact that has on the learners and their bespoke needs.
Yeah, no, that's really brilliant. We've got about 15 minutes left. I'm just going to play our messages again, and then you can talk on a positive about the green shoots that you're seeing and the sustainability of it as well. So we'll come back in just a moment.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more, and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
And we're back. And if anybody is listening who'd like to ring in or put a message in the chat to ask Zoe a question about her her journey into assistant headship, as she's been describing this evening, and it feels like it's been a bit of a roller coaster. And we've heard a lot about where you got from. So if you do want where you got to, if you do want to phone in, download the Podbean app and go to ttr.radio.org. Zoe, please, can you tell us about the green shoots and how you're feeling now, a year in?
Well, I'm really proud. You know, I'm really proud of myself in terms of taking that, because you know, you said at the top of the show that I've been teaching for 24 years, and actually it's only 1 year into, you know, senior leadership, and that's because, you know, I think I was spent a long time at that middle leadership. Not only did I have my children and lots of kind of different, but you know, whilst I was doing a master's degree in education and kind of upskilling myself, I think there was always an element of kind of self-doubt or reluctance to kind of just throw myself into it. You know, we all suffer a little bit from imposter syndrome, or therefore being just kind of used to that habitual everyday things that we used to be doing for years. And I think for me, it was really time, having focused on, you know, upskilling and investing in the pedagogy. And you know, I did an MPQ, and I feel really ripe and passionate that I wanted to take that jump. And I'm really pleased I have done, because, you know, I think that bravery that I took has been rewarded by, you know, an electrifying, and you know, for want of not sounding cliche, but it's been electrifying. It's kept me on my toes. It's made me feel alive again. Mm. It's made me feel empowered, genuinely empowered. Mm. Yeah. And you know, the best thing for me to feel empowered is to show how I can empower others.
Yeah.
And to come into a scenario, so those green shoots in terms of professional development, you know, being making my new team aware of the kind of CPD opportunities that are out there that they can take. And I'm pleased to say that so many of my colleagues have grabbed them with both hands and are really enjoying their journey of development as well. By myself providing, ensuring that I was providing some really, you know, top class, and making, you know, holding myself to high account in terms of the CPD that I delivered as on a whole school, and ensuring that I often got feedback and was it meeting the needs of what we needed, and that kind of rigorousness that it was always embedded in the research and that kind of pedagogy and the things, the culture that I was that I'm trying to create with my team in terms of that real emphasis and importance on teaching and learning.
Yeah.
And us doing the teaching right and the kids doing the learning right and making sure that those can marry. So I think, I feel the green shoots are definitely evident in terms of a change of culture and some successes in the classroom with our cohorts. Obviously, I hope that, you know, our GCSE results and our SATs results, and we see them in those kind of big milestones, but also the little wins, like making sure that literacy, that kids have got books because they've never had a book before, you know, to take home in their bag, and making sure that they're getting that kind of high quality first teaching that kind of can be inspiring, but also making sure that our staff feel valued and know where they can go. And something I'm really proud of is working on that, on a coaching program. So having upskilled myself in a master's in terms of coaching, making sure that that authenticity, the process of genuine coaching is being delivered within our school, and I'm really seeing that start to happen, and not be it being used as so often it can do in schools of some kind of punitive, oh, there's a tick box, do a bit of coaching, go and improve that person's not doing questioning well, go and coach them and show them how to, but really knowing the difference between mentoring and coaching and making sure that process. I'm really proud of that. So the kind of growth in teaching and learning is definitely that kind of green shoots. We're watering it, we're feeding it, and it's growing and growing, and hopefully it'll be there flourishing for
Can I just ask you, and I don't know, I'm just going to throw this word out at you, micro affirmations, okay? So micro affirmations, we hear so much about microaggressions, but how do you reward the staff and let them know that you're pleased with what they're doing? What would you say is going on in that department?
Well, I think, again, that communication, that transparency, that the constant being approachable as an SLT, but making sure that kind of comes in both ways, where I can approach people and say, well done, I really loved coming into your lesson today. I loved, or I've heard from students that you did that. And people, you know, always congratulating people on their hard work. And even if I haven't heard anything and I've seen somebody, I'm making sure that as an SLT, we always make our staff know that they're valued by kind of giving them verbal contributions. We also share staff postcards and make sure we put postcards in trays and things that we want to do. We've looked at an open door fortnight, and so therefore we encourage all of our staff to go and look at shared good practice, and not through a critical eye at all, but we welcome everyone to use a Microsoft form to ensure that they record something positive that they've seen in whatever lesson or phase that they've popped into, or key stage, that they record something positive. And then I share that with the staff. Sometimes it's anonymously in terms of, oh, here's all the great things. Sometimes it's more of on a personal basis where I can say, so-and-so said that they've seen this in your classroom and they're brilliant. And I think it's a sense of, making sure that we appreciate each other, and we, and so therefore we can have that cohesive nature as a staff. And I'm really lucky that they're really quite absorbent and very reactive to wanting to get better and wanting to kind of learn more. And I'm very aware that that's not the culture in all schools. I haven't been in some cultures before where sometimes they're kind of quite reticent to take on new things and thinking, well, it ain't broke, so don't fix it, rather than that constant strive for better and development. And I think we congratulate the effort, not necessarily the end result, but also congratulate the effort and the willingness to learn and model that learning to our students. So yeah, I think my staff, equally, we've kind of gone to a educational conference, and so we do some trips out, and that gets paid for the staff that want to, and then a free pub lunch in there, is it? So social, yeah.
It sounds lovely. Yes, a pub lunch. Well, there you go.
Another way of bribing our staff with alcohol.
You have me at conference. So the final piece of the puzzle then, we've got just over 5 minutes. The piece of the puzzle, sustaining it.
Yes,
indeed. What happens next?
Yes, well, we need to make sure that we can monitor and ensure that it's embedded and it's not some kind of new fandangled fad that then kind of comes and goes. So, I think that's the boring bit, isn't it? That's the boring bit where we make sure. I think we talked about habits earlier and we're talking about it becoming embedded, and I think if something's habitual and it once it's working, I think then it's making sure that we keep monitoring and reflecting and if it's that still part of our vision or if we can move on. And so that sustaining, ensuring that if it was worthwhile investing in the first place, then making sure that we're continuing to monitor and reflect on how well, because actually things change, context change, society changes, the needs of individuals change for a variety of reasons. So if we've embedded that change, how does that, for example, actually the uniform was one of the noticeable changes, the first changes that we made, yet we're adapting that because we want to invest in a house system. So therefore the uniform's going to change ever so slightly in terms of a colour on a tie this time, whereas this time last year we were scratching around for just anybody to wear a tie. And now kind of we've invested in that kind of pride. We're looking for that pride to belong to a certain house system. So again, I think the sustainability comes from the monitoring, comes from the consistent approach of making sure that it's embedded and making sure that it's manageable for your staff, you know, manageable, because if something is unmanageable, then it's never going to be able to be sustained. It needs to be something small, manageable chunks that can be part of your everyday. And I think that's it. And making sure that, you know, you empower other staff to have that in their responsibility. So it's not one person taking the responsibility of everything, it's everybody having shared responsibility for that area to be moving forward, because not one person can change. It has to be a whole everybody that can keep that change going.
That's absolutely brilliant. And I can see that we have got just 3 minutes left, Zoe. And so I want to just do a couple of quick fire questions. I feel like I should have a sound effect. I haven't got one. I just have to beat myself.
Boom.
Right. What do you think should change in education?
Wow. Okay. I think less of a square peg round hole approach. Okay. I think there needs to be more flexibility. There needs to be more flexibility for staff. There needs to be more flexibility for learners, for different types of learners, and for the kind of, I know we're looking at a different curriculum, but also the exams that they take and the qualifications. Mm-hmm. There still needs to be more flexibility. I think that's the biggest thing.
So just throw it all away and start again, is that what you're doing?
I think take in, well, I think there's a lot around the edges that we need to chip away at. Yes. And I think what we need to do is just focus on what does education mean? Mm. You know, what does education mean to us, and what is it that we need to create for our society to be successful in the future. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we look at our GCSEs or we look at whatever we're trying to force our students into, and it's questionable, and it's questionable. Mm-hmm. And so also this, you know, the flexibility of the profession, it's a very difficult job. And so therefore we need to ensure that we can meet the needs of the people that, so they are well enough to be able to do it and meet the needs of the profession.
What would be your number one top tip for staff wellbeing to promote it?
I would say to ensure that you have a culture of listening, and to ensure that you take every case on its face value, so therefore you can have flexible thinking, because because everybody is individual, and so they need individual things. And I appreciate it's hard to manage, I really do, that's my hesitancy, but I think it's really important that we look at the person that's behind the request or the need, as opposed to just having a blanket rule, because otherwise it requires too much thought.
If you had a magic wand, what would you change tomorrow? One thing, top priority.
What would I change? Oh, wow. There's so many things. Oh, that's a tough one. What would I change? I would shout from the rooftops what brilliant profession teaching is, but I would change the way that we kind of see the teaching profession. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that needs an overhaul. I think people need, I think we're constantly, that recruitment and retention, I think what we need to do is get the brilliant teachers back that have left. And I think we need to make the teachers that are there are working really hard happier. And I think that comes from having effective leaders and less burnout. So, you know, I think that making that, that's quite a lot with one magic wand. Sorry.
it's 6 foot. So, yeah. Brilliant. Okay. Thank you so much, Zoe.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Zoe Neagle, assistant head teacher at a school in Northwest London, and it's been an absolute delight. So thank you so much for sharing your journey and your wisdom with all of us here at Teacher Talk Radio. Please do remember there are shows every week, you can lots of shows every week, all of the time, and you can tune in to ttradio.org and join me again fortnightly at the same time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.